Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
And I think that's what punk did. It put these people to the fore, you know, in a time when not much was happening. But suddenly they were on TV. Susie was on TV in London, you know.
Yeah.
But it was happening so quickly. We had different bands forming every week. Nobody had a clue what was going to happen, but everybody was wanted to be in on it, whatever it might be.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map.
Continuing our origin story.
Were you like super critical of the stuff that was happening so quickly as well? I mean, you were just saying you were like you knew what you didn't want to sound like. It was like more elitist in Liverpool. Like,
yeah.
Devo were okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were okay, a little bit crazy. Split Ends from Australia.
Right.
No way. Too much hairspray. Yeah. They got the wrong end of the stick. Yeah. The Ramones, however, they just were something spectacular, different. The Clash also. The Jam, could care less.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, no, I think we were critical, but we also liked some of the same things. You know, me and Robert loved Buzzcocks, and you know, we all had an affiliation with things like Bowie and T-Rex. You know, so we could weave a web between those dots, you know, and connect those dots together. And anybody that we had as friends that weren't necessarily musicians, the whole sort of tribe of those people, that's what kept them together, you know, those little things. So we realized very early on that music was our way out of that situation. It had, you know, it had to be our future. And like yourself, you know, my mother passed away quite early in my life, and my father, for other reasons, wasn't really available to me. So I felt adrift. You know, and much like young guys, you know, in inner cities in America join gangs because they find, you know, an affiliation, a family there. My family was the Cure, and the people surrounding the Cure. That was my family. That was my whole thing. So I gravitated towards that, and I found solace in that. Mm. For us, it wasn't a hobby. It was existence. There was no other way. Yeah.
We had poverty driving us.
Well, there was that too. There was that. I mean, I didn't really realize how extreme that was until I compared it to other people's stories. You know, I never thought of myself as being, you know, a poor person. I had lots of you know, intellectual stimulus in our house, so it was. I didn't feel like I had lost anything, but I realized I grew up with very few of the niceties of life, you know, early on.
I'm glad I had a duffel coat in Liverpool. That's all.
Oh, bloody right. Yes. Yes.
because there were windows broken in the flat I was in, and that was no fun. I remember sitting around the Cardoma Cafe on the corner, just around the corner from Matthew Street, and thinking, how many can we afford like a cup of tea, you know, and a baked potato between two?
Yes.
It's like everybody, okay, who's going to feed us today?
Of course, there is also the unspoken, large gorilla in the room there in England, which is the class system. Because one of the other things that was driving me was I knew I had something to offer the world, but I knew in England, you know, if you don't come from a certain place or a certain family, you know, life is going to be a lot harder. And so I was kind of, I wasn't an outright Marxist, but I was kind of, you know, I was getting ready to make my mark despite what people might have thought of me in England, you know?
And I think that's what punk did. It put these people to the fore, you know, in a time when not much was happening. But suddenly they were on TV. Susie was on TV in London, you know.
Yeah.
But it was happening so quickly. We had different bands forming every week. Nobody had a clue what was going to happen, but everybody was wanted to be in on it, whatever it might be.
All right, I think that's kind of that's the defining ethos of the era, that we all knew something was happening. We weren't quite sure what, but we wanted to be in on it.
Go on, Lord. When was the time when you felt like you found your voice? You found, this is me. This is the way I want to sound. This is the way I want to create.
You know, people talk about the muse and as if it's an abstract concept, and in certain ways it is. But there's been certain points in my life where I absolutely knew that I was in line and doing the right thing, the thing that I was supposed to do. I mean, I think that's how I quantify, you know, having that creative, artistic alignment. It's when I know that I'm in the flow, when I don't question what it is I'm doing and it just happens. And that started with The Cure, probably about the time of 17 Seconds. I can remember thinking, yeah, that was the pivotal point where I knew that I was doing what I should be doing, and that I had a, you know, I had a part within it.
Isn't it strange? You were playing your style. You were playing your drums the way you wanted to play them.
Right.
And the big difference for me was I could see that you didn't sound like anybody else, and you were in a band that was your band.
Right.
And I, again, was occupying somebody else's drum seat. I'd sat in on Palmolive's drum seat for the Slits and adopted the rhythms and beats of Palmolive. Mm. And then I sat and learned Kenny's parts and his percussion overdubs with the Banshees.
Right.
I mean, I tried to fit in,
right,
and, you know, and make a mark in. But I was more concerned with getting this thing to work. My thinking came from a long line of that, really, from day one. It was, what's my role?
Right.
But you were The Cure.
Right.
You were fully formed.
Yeah. You know, the first album that you did as, you know, fully fledged Banshee, that's still to me the most unusual and genre pushing album that the Banshees did. It was never going to go in the directions it went after you joined, you know.
The Kaleidoscope was, for me, that was the first time, I think, where I found my own voice in a professional situation, and a situation where I there was a good chance that other people would hear it. The first song, the first recording I did with the Banshees was Happy House. And that went through many stages of different drum trials. I went from Keith Moon to Ginger Baker and back again, looking for the extraordinary, and came up with something that became more me. It certainly gave me a voice.
then really is fame and fortune and recognition all that it's cracked up to be. And I will go back to David Bowie's quote about this matter. He said, fame, the only reason fame is any good is for getting a better table at the restaurant. And he's got a very good point. I mean, even though that's quite a sort of flippant answer, but unfortunately, I think it's a double-edged sword. The very thing that makes you obtain those vaulted heights, if you like, is the thing that also can destroy you. And I think that definitely happened for me. And it's like you got to a point where there's a something inside me that was looking for greater meaning, whereas everything that we were doing was actually sort of aimed towards meaningless all the time. A lot of the way fame and fortune is kind of put together is designed to keep you very packaged and very normal, really. And it's that's not what I was ever interested in. I was never interested in normal, you know. And perhaps, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but perhaps a psychologist could tell you that that's because I was kind of scared of normal. Maybe that's it, you know, scared of normal. So when it gets too normal, I get a bit worried, you know.
I wonder how many psychologists it would take to, you know, to figure out the conundrum of longevity versus artistic integrity. Because I think there's a certain amount of, it's like the booster rocket that fires you into orbit, you know.
Yeah.
It's like that momentum keeps you going creatively, regardless of how much people are trying to make you stay in place, conform, damn you. You know, no, let them do that flashing Susie sign on top of the pops. It'll be great for your career. Yeah. And you're going, no, every creative bone in the body's going, no, we will not conform like everybody else. And eventually, maybe the kind of that thrust rocket just kind of, you start to coast. The propellant's gone. And it's not that you've run out of creative juice. It's like, you need to take a break or something. But if you take a break, it's a bit like the mission's over.
Right.
You're stuck somewhere in dark space between the Earth and the Moon. You might eventually go around an orbit, but you might never get home again. I could bring this one to the table, lol, you know, the Peter Pan syndrome, the boy who doesn't want to grow up, who wants to take everybody out to Never Never Land. And yet at some point we have that similar relationships with our front person, these intimate, private and public bonds, if you like. Mm. But once it came undone, once that ceased to be, I think certainly I felt cut adrift, cast adrift. I just mentioned the rocket booster giving out, and it was just like float time. Collapse. For me, it was a total collapse. It wasn't the booze or the, you know, few drugs or whatever it might. It wasn't the rock and roll collapse. It was the physical, mental collapse of me as a person, because Peter Pan didn't exist anymore. I couldn't rely on the fairy tale. It had gone. So then what do we do? I remember the decision. The decision was, I have to find out who I am. I need to do this for me, for nobody else. I'd never, ever put that question or that proposition to myself. And I didn't know how to do it. And I think maybe you understand what I'm talking about.
I always think it was like, you know, at the beginning of sort of the creative journey, I was entwined so much with, you know, with The Cure, with the idea of Robert and me doing things. And that supported my low moments and my high moments all the way along. And then when that sort of evaporated, I became completely adrift. But also there was that, you know, you have to be you know, destroyed in the fire of life to come out anew.
Interesting.
Which is basically, you know, quite a Hindu philosophy, right? But it's like once you're tested in that, then you have a different viewpoint. Maybe for me, you know, there's two points. One point where I got kind of my worst point and I left the cure or was asked to leave. And then the real end of the cure came for me at the Hall of Fame. That's the end of the cure for me. That's my point where I think, okay, there is no more cure for me. After all this time, I feel very grateful to have found somebody like Budgie who has had a completely similar journey in life, and we can reflect on that together and help each other bring out our creative paths again. And that's a wonderful thing. That's also a gift I never expected to receive. I never expected that to happen, and that's what makes it so wonderful.
Right.
We survived it and we made it. And so we should celebrate it. And I think that's really what we're doing now. We're celebrating all the best things that we know from our past and from our present and hopefully from our future. And we're making something, we're making more art. We're making something more tangible out of that, you know?
I would say, if I may venture to say something, that we kind of missed each other the first time round.
Right.
And I could think of many vague moments, you know. Mm. Of course, there are moments when we met and the moments when we probably spent time together.
Yeah.
But I remember when we met up again and you said we should do something together.
Right.
And it just felt the right moment. And it felt the right moment to create a friendship.
Right.
To see if that is something that felt good. And we've made not mistakes or wrong turns. We've just followed where it's led.
Yeah. And that's the thing. The other thing I think is very salient to it is back when we were in our early 20s, you know, We're going like a ricochet around the whole globe and that. And, you know, I don't know that we would have been able to be like this back then. We would have perhaps thought, oh, well, you know, that's nice, but, and it would have gone on like this. And so I remember saying, hey, we should do something together. Let's do something. And I hadn't had that idea until I started talking with you. And I thought, okay, that's what we have to do.
So who are we now, Lol? If we're not Peter Pan, who are we? On this journey, I keep thinking of we are the Gilbert and George of punk.
you know who we are? We're the prodigal sons. That's what we are.
We are. Hello, everybody out there in Curious Question Land. We're going to dig into the mail sack. It's a deep and itchy place down there, and we found one. I think we found one, Lol.
Oh, yeah. So this one, I'm going to attempt to pronounce this name, but it's Spanish, and I'm not sure.
Español.
Español, yeah.
Hmm.
Alejandro. Geraldo Orozco. Mm-hmm. I think that's the last name. And it's directed to you, Budgie.
Para mío.
Hey, Budgie. I don't know if you personally can read this, but I really hope so. I have a question I don't know how appropriate it is for here. Is it true that the Boomerang master tapes are lost? You have no idea how many people want to remaster for the album. Your drumming is fantastic, and I really hope that you still appreciate the album as much as your fans do. The music has even touched the hearts of very young people like me in places like South America. I really, really hope you read this and just wanted you to know. Alejandro.
Are the tapes lost? You know, Cindy sent a shiver down the back because because I've seen the condition of some of those of tapes that are older than Boomerang. Boomerang was recorded, I think, around about 1989, somewhere around that end of the decade there. As far as I know, they're not lost. What I do know is that Boomerang is unavailable. It was discontinued, and therefore it's not I don't even know if it's available on to download at the moment, to stream, or if it's even up on Spotify. And so I'm kind of wondering myself, because I do have very fond memories of the recording, which took us down to southwest Spain, Jerez de la Frontera, north of Cadiz.
Right.
We met the Domecq family of the Sherry fame. We met Fermin Borghese. Borghese was a bullfighter. And we recorded the album in the bodega of his ranch.
Wow.
In the burning heat of the southwest Spain there.
Right, absolutely.
We took Mike Hedges again.
Yes.
We had a 16-track mobile from Abbey Road Studios, portable recording gear.
Right.
Which really didn't like the dry, sandy air of the bodega. Yeah.
Right, sure.
We loved the dry sherry of the of the region, which was made by the Domecq family.
Right.
It was called Laína. And we quaffed.
Is that the sound you make after you've drunk half a bottle of it?
That's the sound you make, because it's very dry. You have to drink it ice cold. And they didn't have a refrigerator. They had a refrigerated room.
Okay.
Wow. When it was so hot, you walked into this refrigerated room and sat and sipped a little while. And my memory again is that that's it. We went in, we did a lot of rehearsing for the album. And we wrote a lot before we got there, which is very unusual. Creatures was always a spontaneous affair, had been until that point. But we had, it came on a Banshees hiatus after a very successful period, being Peep Show. But it was a strange time that we had to take advantage of, because I think we were still very much in the mood for creating something. And there was, I say, there was too much discussion going on in Banshee world. And getting, which wasn't very creative. Anyway, a lot of people have said that they like that album. It's like maybe even preferred it to some of the things. But I suppose it's where you come into Susie and the Banshees world, or Susie's world, or Susie and my world. But it was perhaps a little more instant. And if you came in on Boomerang, there was a lot of variation in song, and it was very much, I suppose, an expose of our more blues roots in a way. And I don't know where those blues roots come from.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, as far as I know from talking to different people here in California, the Creatures are actually sort of more well remembered here than the Banshees. So that blues bit is some of the connection as well, because, you know, at the root of everything, when we started, for sure, you know, there's something that connects you back there to that. So, and you were probably a bigger proponent of it than anybody else, because, you know, you have a deep musical history. So that would have come out, you know?
Very fond memories of, again, another album as Holiday. This is kind of what the Creatures was. It was a break. The only holiday we ever took was like the busman's holidays, we say in England, in Britain.
Yes.
A working holiday.
Yeah.
And that's the story, isn't it? And it was just always looking to be, every tour that finished, we was like, what's it like? Wonder what it would be like to stay on here, and how would it be to live here?
Right, right.
Did you have those experiences when you were traveling? Finish the tour?
Yeah. Sometimes I would just stay. You know, everybody else would go home. I remember, like, I forget exactly, I think it was Holland somewhere, you know, I decided, you know, you catch the ferry home, I'm staying. And I stayed for about a week or so, maybe longer. And then I moseyed home, you know. That's really how I ended up in California. I mean, I didn't come here on, I did come here on tour, but I decided at one point, you know, I'm just going to take a journey and see, you know, go to become a stranger in a strange land again and see where that takes me. And so far, so good.
I do. I remember a Banshees tour finishing on the West Coast, probably in LA. And right. Me, Susie, Severin, and his partner then. All stayed on as if we hadn't had enough of each other, you know, for like several weeks on the road.
Yeah.
But we did. It was December, and of course the weather there was beautiful, and we thought, are we going to go back to London and the cold and the wet and the rain and the crowds down Oxford Street and nowhere's open, and if it is, you've got to have a booking. And we just stayed in LA, and we walked up in the hills, and we had a great time. We tried like fasting, like juice fast for the first time.
Juice fasting. So tell me, how early on was that in the band's history? Was that early or later that you did that?
That was later. That would be okay. You know, it obviously wasn't the end of Peep Show because,
right?
I don't think at the end of Peep Show there would be really no desire to be spending
right
time extra time.
the reason I ask is because when you were talking, I remembered that our first tour in Australia, we ended up at the end of the tour in Perth in Western Australia, and back then, you know, there wasn't, you know, quite the, you know, daily flights from Perth back to London. We had to wait for a week to get a flight back, and we just stayed in a little hotel by the Indian Ocean for a week. And it's one of my most favorite memories of being in the band, you know, because we'd done this tour where we'd played like 23 places in Australia, which, if you know about Australia, is akin to playing like every big city and then some, you know. So we had done Australia in a big way. And but you know, it was kind of at the beginning, so we played some real grassroots place like the Bondi Lifesaver and stuff, you know. And we got to Perth and we played, and we were, you know, it's like 3 or 4 weeks, and we were pretty exhausted. And then we had a week by the Indian Ocean just to have fun and just run up and down the beach was like white sand, like sugar, you know. You couldn't see anybody for miles in either direction. It was just wonderful, you know. And I always think that if we had done more of that with the Cure, you know, perhaps we'd have understood each other more, and perhaps, you know, push wouldn't have got to shove sometimes, you know.
They're magic moments. They really are. They're not so easy to manufacture, but when they happen and they go well.
Yeah.
Susie and I, as the Creatures, were invited down to the 2000 Olympics in Sydney as a part of the opening ceremony there. But the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, they offered to fly all our drums over and bits of equipment and bring us in a week before and kept us on a week after so we could do some shows, so our own gigs around there as well. So we actually got time to, you know, spend time and acclimatize. Otherwise, it's just such a long trip. But it was probably the first time we'd had, you know, to sit around.
Yes. Yes, it's always fun.
But I remember every moment. And that was the beauty of it.
Yes, and that is the beauty of what we do now.
Yeah.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Vol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Spare.
Social media, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
I love saying www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com. And you can reach us on Instagram, Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cure Creatures,
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram and at doubleelvisfm on Twitter. Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2021.